Awesome. Well, we should just probably launch straight into it. Hey guys, we could even use the use this. There's not even any reason to pause. Cut straight into it.
All right.
Cool. Well, all right. Welcome, dear listeners, to the final edition of the Jacobs Podcast for the year 2019.
Forever.
I thought there was going to be an announcement there for
don't
a second.
The closing countdown.
Don't be too hasty, Jordan. Don't be too hasty.
How do I get out of this?
So, the guys just mentioned the noise. So just firstly, a little caveat on the disruption front. So I'm actually recording this not from a pub, but from an outdoor restaurant in Brisbane, Happy Boy and Snack Man. And we've got a...
Are you getting kickbacks? You had to mention the name.
Well, I didn't want to bring the name into disrepute, but I promised I'd give them a plug, Jordan and Cameron. So, yeah. But this is actually a very special episode, other than being the year's end, because Will is actually back from New York and is visiting Jordan in Melbourne. So it's very unusual that we've got both of you guys together in the same spot. We're not having to do a three-way Skype call. So, Will, welcome back.
Great to be here in the remote sound studio for the Jacobs Podcast here in Geelong, in Jordan's office. So, yeah, fantastic to be back in Australia at the moment. So, yeah, it's been a great few days. I'm looking forward to some Aussie summer.
Yeah, definitely. And how long are you actually back for, Will? Are you back for a few weeks or...?
Yeah, for a month in total between semesters at uni over there. So, yeah, great to be away from the freezing cold and warm jackets and, yeah, seeing some old mates here.
Definitely. And Jordan, no doubt Will's a good guest to have over.
Yeah. Yeah, he's okay. No, it's nice to have someone else in my office to talk to. You know, it gets a bit lonely down here sometimes, so this is a pleasant change. Oh. But Sean, what brings you back stateside? What are you up to?
So yes, that's right. I'm back in Brisbane, obviously. I've just come back for the break with Ellie. So just come back to see family, put final touches on wedding preparation, and then, of course, celebrate festivities, etc. So... yeah, and it's obviously a jam-packed time, so I really appreciate you guys making time to do this. So a bit of a year in review, a bit of a capstone will be quite good for the year.
So when you say wedding prep, does that really involve Ellie doing the wedding prep and keeping you out of the way? Is that kind of how it goes?
Mate, my counsel has been very valuable to proceedings, so... I've helped out where I can, but Ellie's been absolutely fantastic. So big shout out to her. And finishing touches. So it'll be a big year next year. So yeah, definitely. And so with sort of getting to 2020, we'll maybe just actually, what are the noticeable differences like coming out of the States? Things are obviously heating up there. We've avoided talking about Trump, of course, in the podcast, and we've done very well about that, but it's hard to avoid some of the big news that's happening over there at the moment pre-Christmas. And what do you sort of gauge just broadly, even more broadly than Trump, about sort of coming back here and what's making news in the States versus here?
Yeah, in many ways, yes, there's a whole lot of news around and the sort of media frenzy around, which just continues around Trump, but... In lots of ways, people are just continuing to live their lives, and it's not a day-to-day concern for a whole lot of people there.
Yeah.
And I think coming back to Australia, I mean, you just you appreciate the environment in Australia. I mean, being down here in Victoria, the city's obviously beautiful, and you kind of appreciate the Australian landscape and maybe the sort of slightly sort of more relaxed nature of Australia, particularly people in New York.
Yeah, no, I can
extreme America. Yeah,
no, I can absolutely imagine. And actually, we were sort of going couple of ways what we're going to do for this podcast, and we just sort of settled on, rather than just doing this, I mentioned previously on the podcast about doing an institutions episode that we've had in the works for a while, and we, rather than do that on this episode, we just probably wanted to do something a bit more relaxed, a bit more year in review. So maybe I'll just kick off with Jordan. You've sent around an article today by Jim Grant on specialisation and becoming an expert. And I know Will and I actually touched on this briefly at the last episode. Maybe just tell us, well, I'll drop it in the show notes, of course, but what provoked that?
Yeah, so I think you actually, it was Paul Graham that wrote that article.
Oh, sorry, Paul Graham, sorry. Yep. My bad, I said Jim Grant then. Apologies.
That's all right. I stumbled on that yesterday and had a read, and I was talking about it with Will this morning over breakfast, and he pointed out that you guys were talking about similar stuff on the last episode, and it kind of inadvertently fed it out that I hadn't listened to the most recent episode between you two, so I was busted on that. Yeah. But yeah, he mentioned that you guys talked a lot about the book Range, the Econ Talk episode on with the author, which I actually listened to as well and thought it was super interesting, and ordered the book as well. And so this article kind of engages with a similar topic around what are the ingredients for extreme results kind of, or extreme success in a disciplinary field. And the two competing arguments is like the David Epstein range side of the coin, where it's you want to take a generalist approach, and then the other extreme, which is the specialization from a very early stage. And I just started flicking through the first chapter of the range book now, and he kind of, you know, the perfect example he has is of Tiger Woods and Roger Federer. Like Tiger Woods being the early age specialization and Roger Federer being the generalist who kind of came into his own a bit later. And so, yeah, we were kind of spitballing around the different examples of where this applies. And I think one thing that kind of struck out to me, I mentioned Bill Gates and Buffett as two guys who kind of more in the Tiger Woods light. Like they started very young and they had like, they weren't necessarily child prodigies, but they had like prodigy type interests from a very early age, which were nourished and allowed to blossom. I think I was saying to Will that if you maybe if you lined up both Gates and Buffett against someone else at the time and did an IQ test, I don't think they would have, you know, blown the lights out. I don't think they would have been, you know, top of the class or anything. But I think it's more the fact that they stuck at it for a long time that really kind of laid it out. But then there's also a question here about like survivorship bias. Like we pick up these people who specialize at an early age, but we don't look at the people who specialized at an early age and it didn't work out for them. Like there's not really a look at that side of the coin. Maybe Malcolm Gladwell talks about this in Outliers, but I thought that was the question that comes up to me is like, what are the nurturing, what can we do to nurture talent? What can we do to nurture success in this way? And so I think this article was a good little expose in it. What did you get out of it?
Yeah, I think the thing that jumped out was that it's kind of the contrast to the Epstein approach of, you know, like, sorry, the Federer approach, which is, rather than specialise, try a whole bundle of things first, kind of experiment, see what you're good at, and then I think specialise much later, which, as you mentioned, is the thesis of the book. And I think Will and I might have spoken about this on the last episode, that I think, you know, like I think with writing books, etc., that you have to set up a dichotomy between, you know, the Woods and the Federer approach. But I think the key solvent is that, you know, however you arrive at something, whatever your skill or specialty is, it still requires a huge amount of hard work and just graft and grit as well in whatever endeavor you actually end up choosing. And, you know, the 10,000 hours principle, I think it was for violinists or whatever it was, but that was the sort of, I think it's supposed to be kind of not that a line in the sand, like if you do exactly 10,000 hours you'll become an expert at this, but probably just symbolic of what's required to become very good at what you do. I think that's the sort of that's the key solvent that ties it together with your Woods or Federer, that you just have to work extremely hard and you've got to be about grit. Jordan, sorry, Will, you'd read the piece. What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And some of this is just about, you know, we can think about whether it's just the sampling period of generalizing and then specializing, rather than jumping straight to that that diving in deep phase. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting. This year, I read Andre Agassi's autobiography, Open, and he's another example of extreme early specialization and dedication to then become a great tennis player. But you know, there's many other people like that who didn't necessarily make it. I think this is a really interesting area. What I also think is,
no, but I just want to probably actually jump in there, Will, if possible, just really quickly, because yeah. You know, Jordan, you said it too, like with this, you know, like I remember, I think it was my dad saying, like, you know, there's, you think about the world, sprinters in the world, you know, like for every Carl Lewis or Usain Bolt or Olympic, whoever, you know, like there's 200 other guys in the world who, you know, would run within, you know, like tenths, you know, a tenth of a second within that time frame who don't make it as well. So like, it's just, you know, that's just says so much about competition, says so much about, like Jordan sort of mentioned about being able to study what about all of these people that haven't made it as well, but who have probably put in, I guess, a lot more, you know, like arguably could have put in more effort at the gym, could have spent, like done more time spent, but haven't actually. So I think that sort of might tie into what you're saying, Will, about not just sort of studying, what both of you guys have said about not just studying the person who's made it, but maybe looking at the people who haven't as well, who have arguably put in as much effort.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly different domains in which to be specialized. But it's somehow the sort of extreme performance more falls out of personal passion for it. And that a lot of these great people aren't aspiring to necessarily greatness in the field. They're more just deeply engaged in that particular location. And the result of that is, you know, outstanding performance, which has an impact. But that's really the byproduct rather than the design of what they're doing.
Mm, that's right.
And if I can add another story to this, which Will and I were talking about over breakfast, which was about a guy who was CEO of a company called Teledyne. His name was Henry Singleton. And this guy was like one of those naturally gifted people. He like played chess blindfolded. He started off as a mathematician and then a physicist, and then he ended up in managing this company called Teledyne. And he racked up one of the best track records as a CEO over like 30 years. And at the Berkshire Hathaway conference, Munger was asked about Singleton, and he was asked, well, you know, why was he so good? Was it stock buybacks? Was it something else? And then Munger said, or, you know, he was a natural freak that helped. But he's like, the more interesting question is, well, why did Buffett do better than Singleton? And he's like, because Warren's not as smart as what Singleton was. I don't think Warren appreciated that statement. But anyway, Munger was saying that the reason why Buffett's track record is better is because he was more focused and more disciplined on what he was working on. And that's why his results have been more more extreme. Well, you know, Buffett's obviously got the best track record ever as a manager. So it kind of ties in with something else that they say, which is that the secret behind their success is not an IQ advantage, it's a temperamental advantage. He's like, to be good in investing or business, you don't need an IQ of 160. He's like, if you've got 160 IQ, give 20 points back. You don't need it. It's going to actually do more damage. He's like, you need a temperamental advantage. You need to, you know, have a strong stomach more than anything. And I think that combined with what he's saying about being so focused, being so disciplined, is kind of like the secret to genius in a way, which I think is what Paul Graham's saying in his article. Like, genius is not an actual thing. It's kind of saying we can develop and acquire over time.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And I think that's where discipline comes into play. And I know we'll touch on in a sec different books we've read this year, but I'm reading a really good one at the moment, actually. A guy who's actually passed away, but his daughter's picked it up and updated this edition, but it's called The Millionaire Next Door, and it sounds like a bit of a sort of wealth...
Rich Quick scheme.
Yes, that's right. But it's a guy by a guy, Thomas Stanley, again, who passed away a couple of years ago, but his daughter has updated it. But the thing that just jumps out to me is it's kind of like a very much a get rich slowly or that kind of thing, and you know, not arriving at wealth instantaneously, but building, as you say, Jordan, the habits and disciplines. And I think there's a stat in the book that, like, the thousands of wealthy people he surveyed, the overwhelming value, I suppose, is that 80% of respondents, like, who are multi-millionaires, have said that's important is discipline. And I think that just really ties in neatly to, I guess, what you're saying there, that it's not so much an IQ advantage, but being able to play the long game over time and, I guess, not get carried away in the short term.
Yeah, and I think tying in with this idea of discipline, I was just saying to Will that, trying to, a lot of the time, these dichotomies like specialization versus generalists and active versus passive management or something like that, a lot of these dichotomies are kind of false, and there's an element of truth to both, and it's the synthesis between them that is the real insight. And I was thinking, you know, what might be that synthesis here? And maybe it's just something, maybe just the secret ingredient, the important element is the flip side of discipline, which is time. It's just you need time with a subject in order to really get these results.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's my heart, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Will, obviously you would have been, you know, having such a long commute over from New York to Australia, you'd have needed to not just listen to music or maybe past episodes of the Jakey's podcast, you would have to read a couple of things, but let it enlighten listeners. What's been maybe not even on the plane, but chewing up your reading time, or what did you indulge in on the commute?
Yeah, well, on the plane, I read the latest quarterly essay by Peter Harcher on Xi Jinping in China and the relationship between Australia and the geopolitical dynamic with the US at the moment. And that was enlightening in thinking about the significant changes which have gone on in China over the past few decades and how that affects Australia. Obviously, this is a huge issue and is only going to continue to grow over the coming decade. So I think it's a really important topic for people in Australia to be thinking about. I checked that out, and also something different for me is reading a novel by Jean Le Carré, a spy novel called The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. I don't know if you guys have ever read any Jean Le Carré. He's quite renowned, and this is the first book of his I've dinner.
Oh, nice one. I tried to read some of him previously, and I found him quite impenetrable. But that was 10 plus years ago, because he's obviously, like, he's known for very complex plots and being able to weave things together. So it probably was a bit beyond my capabilities at the time, and maybe still is. But.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of depth and subtlety. I actually reading this and halfway through, and I'm not sure what's going on. I think that's part of what is what kind of grabs and draws people in.
Fair enough. Sounds like a Jacob's podcast about halfway in. Don't know what you're talking about. But Jordan, what have you been indulging in just recently?
Well, I've got a couple of books lined up for the holidays. One I've just started, which is called, it's a biography by a guy, his name's Edward Thorpe, and the book's called A Man for All Markets. And this guy, he sort of made a name for himself. He started as an academic. He was a physicist. Then he developed this idea that he could beat the casinos at blackjack, and then he kind of became famous because he was the first guy to learn how to count cards. So you've probably seen a few movies about card counters and heard about how they get kicked out of casinos and stuff. This guy actually pioneered it. So he wrote a couple of books back in like the 60s called Beating the Dealer and stuff like that. And that was kind of, he made his name beating the casinos at blackjack and getting kicked out. And he ended up after that developing a very successful career as an investment manager, And yeah, it's just, it's actually a really interesting story. It was one of Charlie Munger's recommended reads, so I'll pick that up. But he was, once again, kind of like the Henry Singleton story. He was like the type of kid who skipped 2 years at school, went to sit a chemistry exam to get into college, and came second and was annoyed because he needed to come first to win the scholarship. So spent a week studying for the physics one, won that, then got the scholarship. He's just one of these natural freaks. And yeah, and just, yeah, it was actually really interesting. I'd never heard, I'd always heard about counting cards, but never really understood how it worked. And he kind of plays it out in the early chapters.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant stuff. Yeah, because it's certainly like a, obviously a very handy skill to have. But it just seems like one of these skills that's hard to, I think you sort of have it or you don't, and you can develop it, but if it's not your forte, then it's hard to acquire.
What about you, Sean? What are you reading?
So I just finished actually, and it's an older book, but Michael Crichton's, I guess it's a semi-autobiography called Travels. And that's kind of been pretty illuminating, because he's obviously quite a, he passed away in 2008, and Michael Crichton, of course, wrote Jurassic Park. He was the creator of ER, he did the great train robbery. He was actually a surgeon as well. And he wrote Westworld as well, which is, yeah. So he's done, and like, I'm just top-lining some of his achievements, because he was quite a writer. And yeah, we're a very interesting guy, and so I just thought the book had been on my list for a while, and I just chanced upon it in the library as a recommended read by one of the librarians, so just indulged in it. And just a spellbinding kind of writer, you know, the shorter paragraphs, a lot of dialogue, good turn of phrase, quite easy to read, and I just found his sort of journey from his early medical school days and sort of why he stayed in medicine even though he didn't really enjoy it. He got some good advice to just think that, what was it, 2 years into his medical degree, went and saw the guidance counselor and was like, oh, I'm gonna quit, and I'm not enjoying this. And then the guidance counselor was said, so, you know, like, so what, you're not enjoying it. And then basically the advice was, you're doing this time, you know, to become a surgeon, because you want to, you know, they impacted this a little bit, because you want to actually see patients, help people, interact with people and engage. And he said that, you know, the first 2-3 years of medical school, you're not doing that at all. And I think it was just such a good bit of advice, because it just shows that, you know, like, the journey to actually get somewhere requires a lot of graft and sort of painstaking work. A lot of the unenjoyable things that really have very little to do with what you're actually in the game for. So it might sort of just tie in, I think, quite neatly with that grit factor about being able to have that sort of stamina to stay with something versus, you know, pulling the ripcord too early, which I sense a lot of people kind of do. So, yeah, that was quite an interesting read that I just finished recently. And, yeah, as I mentioned, I'm reading this book that I've dropped in the show notes at the moment, about, called The Millionaire Next Door by Thomas Stanley and his daughter, Sarah Stanley, which is quite a illuminating read. But maybe not just recent reads, but maybe, Will, I'll loop back to you about big standout reads. It can be essays or books this year, or even podcasts, other than this one, about what sort of jumped out to you in 2019.
Taking that as given.
Yes. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
So one, I think the standout fiction book which I read this year is a novel called The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, and it came out a few years ago. And a book about a boy in the Met Museum in New York with his mother, and there's an explosion in the museum, and his mother's killed, and he takes this painting, the Goldfinch, from the Met Museum in the aftermath of this explosion, and is the kind of story of his life from then, grappling with the death of his mother. And it's an incredible, gripping story, which is this sort of sprawling epic novel across different parts of the U.S. and the world. Yeah, I just found it sort of amazing and completely engaging.
Oh, good on you. It'd be a nice break from fiction, you know, is a nice break, I suppose, from economics textbooks and reading non-fiction.
Absolutely.
Jordan, do you know what fiction is?
No. What is this genre you're talking about?
I think there's there is great value in these sort of in both fiction and non-fiction, and particularly the way fiction can transport us into and really into a story in a particular place or time, and the way characters can be constructed. I think it's really really valuable. What about you, Sean? Any fiction books which stand out for you recently?
Grief. So I was actually just looking back on the books I'd read this year, and Guilty, there's not too much fiction in there. I think it's no surprise that I don't read too much of it. I had an attempt, and I'm sort of still pottering through it, of The President Is Missing, the James Patterson, Bill Clinton book. And it's quite an engaging read. Again, a bit of a page-turner. I think Patterson's, very obviously quite a good storyteller, being how successful he is as a writer. But I sort of potted through that. Ellie had finished it and said it was a fantastic read, so I'll keep persisting with it. That's been the most amount of fiction on the list this year.
What about non-fiction, Sean? You got a standout for the year?
I was looking through, and I think that I finally read George Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier, and Orwell's such a great writer, no surprise, everyone's favourite and that kind of thing, but retouching his stuff has been quite interesting. He obviously made a concerted attempt to live among the working class, and Down and Out in Paris and London's one of my favourite books, where he works in a restaurant in Paris, and then obviously goes back to London, spends time there. But The Road to Wigan Pier is his time living among the coal miners, and an in-depth account of what it's like living among and the graft and the hard work involved. And it's not a long book, but it's certainly very well written, and just I think quite a masterclass in good simple writing, but really sharpened and hardened among sharpened by living among everyday people, and in this case what's involved in mining and coal mining. So that sort of jumped out. To tie into what we're talking about before, and then I finally got around to reading Angela Duckworth's book Grit, which is getting a bit dated now. It's probably 4 or 5 years old, but that was on the reading list for a while, and I finally got hold of a copy of that from the library and had a read. And I probably don't want to add too much there, but I think it just ties into, I guess, what we're talking about before, the characteristic of a Buffett, I guess, not being the smartest person in the room, although probably in the room, I guess, in most rooms, but having that grit and that determination to stay with things. And the big lesson out of that was stamina is what counts and not intensity. And that was the big takeaway message in that from Angela Duckworth. So out of a long list, I don't want to brag, but I covered around 87 books this year. So those are the two that stood out for me. Jordan, shock horror. I'm back.
Mate, where are you finding the time?
Making the time.
Yes, exactly, Jordan. Your lack of discipline.
Are you neglecting your fiancé? Have you spoken to her?
But I've been engaged. I've been a very good fiancé. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about that. But judging by your reaction, Jordan, you've had a new addition to the family this year, so I'm not going to pick on you. But
yeah, I think now that I think about it, I have been reading I've been reading children's books. So I think I've read more children's books than non-fiction books this year, which is it's not that bad. trying to think about some key books I've read this year. I haven't read that many. I've actually been doing a lot more reading work-wise, as in a lot of financial reading. So in terms of books, I'm just actually one book I read recently was more towards the start of the year. It was Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
I also read this year.
Yeah, and that was fantastic. Just see it in my mind in terms of impact and I was expecting it to be a much more in-depth story about his time in the Holocaust, but it was really like a psychological study of himself and others in the camps, and then translating that into his sort of clinical therapy or clinical recipe in terms of getting the most out of you and your life. It was incredibly powerful. I loved it. So
it's certainly a top read for a lot of people. You know, when you go, I remember, I think it was probably late last year, I read Tim Ferriss's Tools of Titans, and just, you know, where he covers a lot of people who are very successful across a range of industries. And then it's the standout, like, top book for everyone, you know, like, in that book anyway, who... but I've yet to actually read it, so I know you've recommended it and it's on the top of the list, but, certainly seemed like a great read.
Sean, you'll love it.
Yeah, cool. The thing that stands out in that book it's also beautifully written, and there's some incredibly inspiring moments, and also the kind of community which develops in this, you know, the most difficult circumstances, and when there's somehow, you know, this place where these camps where, you know, people can be at their most despairing, and yet there's this these great moments of humanity between a lot of this between the prisoners, but sometimes with the guards there, and it's a beautiful beautiful book.
One of the things I got out of it, he describes his philosophy as tragic optimism, I think, and tragic in the sense that he, like, living in that environment, you develop a new sense of expectation about what you know what's important in life and what's valuable to you, and he's like, you need to be tragic in the sense of realistic about what matters. He's like, you know, what mattered to him was that he still had control, he still had choice in how he responded to things, and just something as simple as that, like lowering your expectations, helps psychologically. But the other thing, the other element of that was also having the optimism, the hope that things would get better. He's like, one of the key things he noticed for other people that were in the camps is that he knew when they'd lost all sense of hope. And he was like, it wasn't the physical situation that really killed people, it was when they'd lost hope. He's like, whenever he saw someone smoke a cigarette, because he's like, usually people had one or two cigarettes on them, and it was like, that was kind of like their savings in the bank. They'd hold on to it because of, you know, there was a brighter future ahead. Saw someone smoking a cigarette, he's like, it was a sign that they'd given up and they were likely going to die in the next couple of weeks. And I thought that was really, really powerful idea, this the blending of realism and optimism at the same time. It was awesome.
Yeah, and I think that's like quite an interesting point about, because one of the things that I've, you know, switching to things that I haven't read but just gained a bit more knowledge on, is I've went through the whole series of World War II in colour. And I think watching that and seeing, I think, you know, that sense of not seeing something in black and white, seeing it in colour, makes it a bit more real, I suppose, to a modern audience, and certainly made it a bit more real to me. But it certainly drove that sense of gratitude, and I think being grateful for what you've got. And I sense that is from what you guys are saying, a key message in that book as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Now, there must have been, other than books, TV shows, essays even, that are worth a mention this year.
Yeah. Maybe before we jump to that, I just thought I'd mention my standout non-fiction book.
Sure, sorry, of course.
No, it's okay. And so that was The Path to Power, the first volume in the Years of Lyndon Johnson, the five-part biography of Lyndon Johnson by Robert Caro, which is just it's still work in progress. He's still working on the fifth and final volume of this epic biography series, and it's known as one of the great biographies of the 20th century, and I can see why. It's incredibly detailed and put together, and is an incredible sort of study of a person and their sort of pursuit of power and just that. So that was I've got the second volume ready to go, so I'm looking forward to starting that at some point.
Nice one, Will. What prompted you to give it a go? I mean, obviously it's a well-known book in biographical circles, but is there anything about LBJ that interests you?
I think it's another one which is a lot of people speak about as being powerful for them. And I think what I appreciate from this is that it's not just about Lyndon Johnson, it's about the United States over this period, which Lyndon Johnson's life covers from, the start of the 20th century through to the end of Lyndon Johnson's life in the 70s, and so that so covered with that sweep of America, which is quite incredible. And things, from the Depression and LBJ's move to the Vietnam War, and that's what's incredible about the work too.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think you've obviously something's tweaked your interest in that period in history, because is it the Robert Burns documentary as well, especially the Vietnam War period?
I'm halfway through that. I haven't been fortunate enough to be on a plane in which they've had the second half, so I can finish the Robert Burns book. I guess part of it is living in the US and being over there has made me sort of interested in this period of US history. I'm currently reading the first book which Robert Caro wrote before turning to Lyndon Johnson, and that he wrote a biography of Robert Moses called The Power Broker, which is Robert Moses was the great city planner in New York City.
That's right.
From the in the early sort of the first half of the 20th century, when there was huge developments in New York, and really he really reshaped the city as it exists now. And so, obviously being there, triggered my interest in that book and learning more about the history of New York.
Yeah, fascinating. Jordan, have you read any good biographies this year other than Charlie Munger or Warren Buffett?
Yeah, aside from rereading the Munger biography for the third time, no, I haven't actually read anything else good this year. But you did mention TV shows, and I was going to say reruns of Seinfeld, which have been great on Channel 10. I actually just finished watching Mad Men for the second time. I don't know if you guys have seen Mad Men. But I reckon that's my favourite TV show of all time, and it was better watching it a second time. It was just awesome. Have you seen it, Sean?
No, but it's on the list of, and it's like The Wire. It's on the list of shows that are a must watch and a high recommendation. But just very quickly on the Seinfeld, when I saw I've actually been seeing guys around that look like Larry David. And
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Well, I just remember there was a website I heard of years ago. I don't even know if it's still in operation, but it's like men who look like Kenny Rogers. And it's like, I was thinking about starting a men who look like Larry David one. And this guy would be first on the. I can't remember. Must have seen him in NZ. Or maybe it was traveling to Adelaide a few months ago. This guy looked like a dead. And I actually thought it was him, but I was like, he couldn't be in Adelaide, he wouldn't be in Australia, but he
actually speaking of doppelgangers, next time you watch an episode of Seinfeld, take a close look at young Jerry Seinfeld, because he looks very much like my younger brother, Alex. And now Al has been asking for me to shout out to him for a while, so here it is, Al. You look like Jerry Seinfeld. So, yeah, take a close look when you're next watching.
Okay.
That's right. And even Al, there was a guy on a, I think it was an Aussie, gosh, I forget the name now, but it was an based in Canberra, a show on Netflix about the intelligence world and the China threat and that sort of thing. But there's one of the characters in that who looks exactly like Al too. I did take a photo of it and sent it to Al when I was watching it, and he is an absolute dead ringer. So there's got to be a man who looked like Alan Shopov, or Alex Shop.
Yeah, and actually, not to get too caught in the weeds here, but he's also been mistaken for Ray Romano as well. So yeah, I think we're onto something. This might be a whole episode in itself. So,
okay. Fair enough.
What about you, Sean? Apart from other media, apart from books, be they podcasts, TV, essays.
Yeah, sure. So I mentioned World War II in Colour, which has been a big one this year. I've almost finished watching Peaky Blinders, which has been a recommendation for a while, which has been a great show. So far, The Crown, I've kept up with that. I was very skeptical of watching that for a while, and finally got onto it at Ellie's recommendation, and was very, very hooked. So I got through that this year and just watched the most recent series of that.
How accurate is that meant to be, Sean? Have they been artistic license with one?
Yeah, different sort of accounts, and from sort of, I guess, obviously it's dramatised to a degree, but the events are very real, and I sense that the reactions to the characters to them are quite, from what you hear from people, quite accurate too. But I think they run a good line, they run a very delicate balance about not over-egging, over-speculating, and I think just being consistent with the characters and how they would react behind closed doors to things. And I mean, what would I know? But I think that they do a decent job there.
Do you reckon the royal family sits down once a week and watches an episode? Do you reckon is a fan of the show?
I can't remember if this is something I read or something I heard, but apparently the Queen has seen it, supposedly, and does think that...
And threw a shoe at the TV?
Well, does think that Claire Foy, who was the Queen previous... series does a good job, apparently, but that's just what you hear. So but the sets and the writing, the acting does give you a certain level of kudos, and to just a lot of the good shows out there these days. About being a good screenwriter, I think, is probably a very, very good skill to have, and not just being a writer, but being able to put something on the screen is and to write well, good plots for TV is a great skill.
I wanted to plug my favourite podcast of the episode of the year was the Range Econ Talk, which we discussed in the last episode, and I thought was fantastic. Come into all the listeners out there. But I think one of the most interesting ideas that I came across this year was from an essay in the Atlantic magazine called We Need a New Science Progress. And it's essentially about the idea that that we need to study the nature of progress, and that that we actually understand relatively little about how there's progress in how society works, innovation, these types of things, and that obviously this cuts across a whole lot of areas of disciplines and so on, and that drawing together these insights from the social sciences and if we want to encourage more progress.
Have you read that one, Jordan?
I haven't actually read it, but I did. There was an interview that Mark Zuckerberg actually interviewed the two of them.
Yeah, I heard this too. Yeah,
I started listening to it and then got annoyed and just thought, I'll just go read the paper. So I haven't got around to it. But you've reminded me of a video I watched last year on a similar topic, which was Matt Ridley's lecture at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Did you watch that?
Yeah, you sent it to me, yeah.
Similar idea. I don't know if I sent that to you as well, Sean. I think the talk was titled How People Take a Screw in a Light Bulb or something like that.
Yes.
Or How Many People Take from Death.
Yeah.
And his talk was about the same thing. Where does progress come from? And he starts his talk off with the example of the light bulb and points out that the light bulb was discovered by numerous people at the same time in various parts of the world. And he's trying to say that, similar to what Will just said, we know very little about how innovation actually happens. And I think the underlying talk is that it's not necessarily in academia. It's actually a lot of trial and error outside of academic institutions where a lot of the big... I'm not trying to talk down...
No.
I think he's making a very important point. He's like, where does progress come from? And still don't understand it well enough, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And actually that point... Ridley's lecture sounds very much like it was an entree to his latest book, which I think he touches on that the light bulb example there as well.
Yeah.
And reading. But, All right, gents. Well, I guess we're sort of getting close to time, but is there anything else that you wanted to indulge listeners in recapping on 2019?
Yeah, I was thinking, I was trying to think of key events of 2019, like landmark things that stood out to me. One of which was actually there was two, and I'm gonna make the outrageous suggestion that maybe they're interrelated. The first one is negative interest rates. It's been going on for a couple of years, but it hit a new extreme. I think it was around August, September this year. There was something like $16 trillion of assets globally with rates, mainly government bonds, and that's. I think it was impossible to figure negative interest rates, not only $16 trillion worth. So that's one event which I think we'll look back on it going. Another one was the Extinction Rebellion. The climate alarmism, I think, hit peak. So maybe they're interconnected. I don't know how. Maybe negative interest rates is what's going to happen with the weather in 100 years, and we need interest rates to rise so people focus on the present instead of the future. That's why outrageous claim for 2019.
I think, obviously the Australian election was a big event. And, maybe we're building on Jordan's... I think it's interesting. Yes, I would agree that climate... alarm about and concern about climate change has reached new levels, which is I think, an interesting development. And... also, there's a lot of technological progress and innovation about. I was talking about in the energy and technology space, which I think is interesting. And there was Andrew McAfee has a new book, War with Less, which I think is very interesting in showing that developed countries are actually producing more output using less total input now. So there's actually, we're becoming, less energy intensive in generating economic growth, which is kind of an inflection point. And it's like we've changed direction in actually using less materials as a result of technological progress. And this dematerialization, if that continues, is, a very interesting trend going forward in thinking around these issues of climate change and resource use.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And I wonder, how much of that is a response to, the Extinction Rebellion type or the political pressure versus just simply what's happening in the world of innovation itself and resource usage.
I mean, I think from my perspective is that this is being driven by the latter, by technological innovation in this space rather than, political developments necessarily. And I think that's what we'll see. And it's obviously one to watch going forward.
Yeah, for sure. And I do think that is an area that's a huge blind spot, I sense, in the fact that there's not a lot of understanding about what's happening in the world of innovation or you know, energy usage. It's kind of this, you know, talking about dichotomies before, about the industries that we're going to rely on to reduce emissions, to use less resources, etc. There's not a whole lot, I guess, known. I would even argue there's a sense of ignorance about what those industries do, how they conduct business, how resource usage works. And I think that's one of these gaps that needs to be bridged when confronting the future around, you know, reducing emissions and becoming more efficient. And I think this is very much something that Matt Ridley talks about as well. There's a lot of majesty and sophistication in innovation, but it's not so well understood or appreciated. Maybe Jordan, you've got something to say there about innovation and how these things tend to work. But, you know, maybe that's something that is to explore for next year, about bridging that gap and maybe exploring a bit more that link between innovation and I suppose give better outcomes environmentally.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it, picking up on Ridley, because, you know, his book, The Rational Optimist, I think the more with less idea that McCarthy's talking about is very much optimistic. We may not know what innovation will deliver us, but we kind of trust in the process that we will get better and use our resources more efficiently and dynamically to solve the problems that we may not be able to see how we'll do it yet. And so that's, in terms of climate debate, it's much more we adapt to challenges that arises rather than we need to mitigate and change the entire energy landscape before the fact. So yeah, to me, I think that's a very interesting counterpoint to the general consensus that we need to reduce emissions drastically and need to focus on. It's a much more static idea, I think, that one is, rather than looking more open-ended gains from trade type approach, where we can innovate our way out of the challenges.
Yeah, for sure. I touched on things for next year to maybe look at. And I know this time last year when we did this exact podcast, I was talking, a lot of my predictions for next year would be talking more about values and capitalism, that 2019 would be the year of values and capitalism. And I'm not sort of sure that that's actually turned out. Yeah.
I think from the, there's certainly a lot of discussion about this in the US and, in the Democratic primary process. About the nature of capitalism and whether we, how we need to reshape this, whether we actually need, a more socialist or Nordic model, or if the problem is, not necessarily enough capitalism, there's too much crony capitalism rather than with business linkages with. Rather than that discussion is happening, but maybe hasn't reached the sort of. But it's hard to make these predictions, Sean. So
I had a failed prediction as well. I think my big thing was that the Fed rising interest rates into 2019 is going to have some interesting impacts. It's been going down. Maybe we can make some more failed predictions for next year.
I can't recall if I was stupid enough to say something.
You were the only one with the humility.
Well done, Will. Maybe it's a process of inversion. So we make predictions and then don't do what we say, or just like what we say won't come to fruition, so focus on what's not said. But Will, I sense that I do feel a bit better now, because I actually just read recently Marco Rubio gave a speech last month where he talked about values and capitalism, and his big, I can't remember what it's the term that he used, bad for forgetting, but it's his thing was around the dignity of work and incentivizing companies through the tax code to do more for their employees, because a lot flows from the lack of dignity in work and sort of living at the margins all the time, and just sort of seeing employment as some sort of way to just simply take home a paycheck and not find any meaning in it. And there's a lot of good sense in that, but I think this will open up a a bit of a cleavage in the debate around the role of business, and I guess what can be done to trim the rougher edges of capitalism, which is what the sort of going argument is. And I think that's probably going to be quite an interesting discussion. Who knows, we'll see for next year. So maybe I missed my years up. That was before my time.
What's the saying? There's no difference between being early and being wrong.
I like it. But yeah, what are sort of thoughts for next year, gents? Maybe I'll just reapply that one for next year. What are your thoughts about things that... Maybe, Jordan, tell us about sort of Planet Finance and what your thoughts are there.
Well, I got Planet Finance wrong this year, so maybe I should avoid doing too much speculation about next year. But I feel like, kind of I mentioned before, like the whole negative interest rates just seems... Yeah, it seems to be nuts where things are at. So I just feel like, you know, something can't stay that way forever. It's got to change at some point, and you know, maybe that's next year, maybe that's not, but I guess we'll see what happens. But I wouldn't mind picking up on one thing you talked about then, which was the capitalism versus values stuff. I think if anything this year, the debate has actually been more capitalism versus socialism, and I thought that's interesting that it's gone back to that that debate. And I think maybe actually, if I was going to look at something for next year, like big event, it's obviously the 2020 US election, and you know, the Democratic primaries rolling on, and maybe that debate will become even more vigorous. Like if Elizabeth Warren wins the Democratic nomination, that'd be super interesting. Like she'd be the most socialist candidate in a long time. Seeing how that debate would play out would be very, very interesting. So yeah, that's what I'm thinking about for next year.
Yeah, fascinating. And I think that, you know, when was it, last week, the UK elections were quite illuminating, and I think probably a referendum on that capitalism v socialism dynamic, and I guess with a resounding or overwhelmingly resounding I sense non-socialism versus pro-capitalism vote. But yeah, I think that's a good point actually. And I think it just sort of shows as well just the salience of ideas, and how, you know, a lot of these debates just keep recycling themselves. You know, I think Milton Friedman, praise be upon him, if he was around today, he'd probably be, be surprised perhaps that we're still having the same discussion, but at the same time maybe not surprised about, you know, the role of... government in a free market economy, inequality, how active should the state be in economic affairs, those sorts of things, are going to be timeless and with us for forever, regardless of the level of affluence that we reach.
The US election is going to be a big event, which I think we're going to have to look at managing our time and how much time we spend engaging with versus the actual event itself. I'd agree on that and particularly how the House of Representatives and Senate shake out alongside the presidency is going to be almost as important as the president itself, I think, in the ability to reshape or not the US. And that this will have, whoever is the next US president, will have big impacts on geopolitics. And kind of thinking back to what I was talking about earlier around, developments in China, Hong Kong. This is really important for kind of the international system, and whether we revert towards perhaps the more rules-based order which we've been operating under, or transition to more of an open, continue the recent adversarial trend between the US and China, perhaps in the nature of that Hank Paulson argument. He gave a great speech in talking about this potential divide between the US and China becoming more entrenched and greater and more hostile. That's a dangerous prospect going forward.
Yeah, and actually that was one of the standout pieces I read actually this year that you put us onto, Will, was Hank Paulson's speech. And a lot of that was actually asking more of China, I sense, the more of a global player it becomes. And I guess a lot of what his diagnosis has been is that they haven't been, stepping up to the plate or being as a responsible global player than what I guess is required of them, given their status in world affairs or within a global economy now. And so I think maybe actually there's something in that for next year, because I do find that a lot of commentary tends to focus on China's specific economic growth, its growing strategic relevance, its military spending, versus the internal characteristics of the Chinese state and how domestic politics in China matters as much as its foreign policy does as well. And I do find that a lot of commentary does lag on China in actually analysing what the Chinese government, i.e. what Beijing is actually doing and the policy and governmental strings it's pulling, versus actually its conduct in Southeast Asia or in the Indo-Pacific. So that's probably going to be an area to watch maybe for next year.
I agree. And it's interesting that there seems to be sort of, parts of, with the US stepping back from being such a supporter and advocate for international institutions, that China is in some ways being viewed as now the responsible stakeholder in relative to the US. But how that plays out in practice, I think, is really important going forward. There is still the prospect of moving towards more authoritarian states. Certainly in areas like Eastern Europe. Relative to the functioning of democratic countries, I think this is also a potential area of concern.
All right, gents. Well, any wrap-up thoughts? It's been a pleasure with both of you, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of all listeners out there when I say thanks so much for a great year. I've really enjoyed Will. You joining us from New York and taking the time, and Jordan as well from Melbourne, all what you've had on this year, and the time that you both devoted to the podcast has been absolutely fantastic, and your intellect and your insights haven't been lost on listeners, but haven't been lost on me as well. So a big thank you to both of you in 2019 for being big contributors to the JTLS podcast.
Thanks, Sean. And thank you to you for organising us every couple of months. Your effort is very much appreciated. I enjoy these talks a lot, but we don't do much of the effort organising it. So thanks for making it happen.
Oh, cool.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Sean. Really enjoyed another year. And looking forward to continuing that. And it's been great to be doing one live here in person with Jordan. And I look forward to the three of us doing one live in person at some point. So yes,
some point next decade.
Yes, yeah. That's right. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in this year. Of course, it's been a busy year. Didn't quite get to the number of episodes that I wanted to get to, but we hope you tune in next year. And apologies in advance for sound quality and the clinging of glasses and cutlery in the background. It hasn't been me. Thank you for your patience. And thank you, gents. Good luck for all the best wishes for 2020.
Thanks, Sean.
You too. Talk to you soon.